Chapter 39, Naples, Rome and Florence. Terry and I spent 2 nights in Brindisi. During the second night, there was a storm with plenty of thunder and lightning. It also rained heavily, so on our leaving for Taranto the following morning, in bright, clear weather, there was an agreeable freshness in the air, and the olive gardens, vineyards and tobacco fields of the flat countryside through which we passed had a rejuvenated look. Taranto, on the Gulf of that name, was a modern town and much larger than we had expected. But though it was a modern town, there were no signposts, and we found our way through it with difficulty, incidentally catching a glimpse of the sea and of the old town on its island. Taranto, behind us at last, we drove on through a number of much smaller towns, all the time gradually ascending. At Castellaneta, there was a large, gaudy monument to Rodolfo Valentino, the archetypal romantic hero of the Hollywood silent films, and at Matera we found people living in what apparently were abandoned stone quarries. From Matera onwards, the road became steeper. So much steeper did it become, and so numerous were the bends, that I was overcome by altitude sickness, and we had to call a halt. Terry was unaffected, and while he ate a good lunch, I started reading Aristotle's Ethics, which I had begun a few days before, but soon fell asleep. We then pressed on through the mountains to earthquake-prone Potenza, 2,700 feet above sea level. The scenery was very fine, and with its wooded slopes reminded me of that of Switzerland. After Potenza, there were more towns on peaks, and I had another attack of altitude sickness. This time we did not stop, except to buy grapes at Eboli, our descent being in any case slowed down by all the road-widening work that was going on. Soon we were out of the mountains and driving through Campania, past the British War Cemetery, and past field after field of tomato plants. When we were a few miles short of Salerno, we turned off the main road to the Lido di Salerno campsite, where we arrived at 7:30, having driven more than 230 miles and crossed from one side of the Italian peninsula to the other. The camp was situated within a few yards of the sea, and before retiring we went for a stroll on the beach. There was a strong wind blowing, though the sea was a little rough with big breakers. To me, the sight was very appealing. Salerno was famous in medieval times on account of its medical school, the earliest in Europe. Now it's a popular holiday resort. And as Terry and I drove into the modern town via the coastal road, we saw that the beaches were strewn with litter. Indeed, parts of them were being used as rubbish dumps. The town's principal monument, the 11th century cathedral, was a building of considerable interest. In front of it there was a spacious quadrangular courtyard, the arcades surrounding which were formed of ancient Corinthian columns that no doubt once belonged to a pagan temple. The bronze doors of the cathedral were of Byzantine workmanship. At the time of our arrival, a prelate, perhaps the bishop himself, was celebrating morning mass for the benefit of a very small congregation. But we were able to see the apse mosaics, where a rather naturalistic Virgin Mary was the central figure, and the two inlaid marble pulpits. From Salerno we drove to the resort of Sorrento, situated round the tip of the peninsula of that name, following the scenic coastal road, and turning aside to visit Ravello on the way. Not that we had to make much of a turn. The little town or village clung to the face of the cliff, almost immediately above the road, so that the climb up to it, past orange trees and lemon trees and curious rock formations, was a steep one. At the top of the steps stood the cathedral, built in the 11th century, thus our self-appointed guide. It had been modernised at the end of the 18th, though the Corinthian columns that had then been enclosed were in process of being freed. In the shabby sacristy we found a fine Sienese-style painting of the Virgin and Child, and some old vestments. We were not able to see the 12th century mosaics. Tomorrow, the town will be celebrating the feast of the cathedral's patron saint, and the interior walls of the building were entirely covered with crimson draperies. Strings of coloured electric light bulbs were still going up, a form of decoration not at all to my taste. Like those we'd seen on the way, the shops outside the cathedral were selling the local handmade pottery. In one of them we approached for alms by an elderly, respectable-looking nun in black, the first religious mendicant we had seen. Having myself lived on alms for a while, I wanted to give her something, but before I could do so, the woman shopkeeper intervened with what was evidently a scolding for bothering us, and she turned silently away. Driving on from picturesque Ravello, the hackneyed epithet is unavoidable, along the winding, rock-cut coastal road, we passed in quick succession through the no less picturesque Amalfi, Praiano and Positano. Whitewashed houses, nestling amid orange trees and cypresses, climbed tier upon tier up the hillside to our right, and on our left fell tier upon tier down to the soft blue of the Tyrrhenian Sea. Little rocky peninsulas thrust themselves out into the calm waters, their every coign of vantage occupied by the colourful umbrellas and tiny thatched pavilions of the bathers. It was an idyllic, even a paradisiacal scene, and one that in its opulent loveliness rivalled the more austere beauty of coastal Greece. But of course there was a serpent in this paradise, in the form of the slow-moving, pollutant, emitting streams of cars, coaches and campers, of which we were ourselves a part. So slowly did the stream move in the hot sun, at times crawling along bonnet to bumper, especially when we turned and crossed the other side of the peninsula, that it was not until mid-afternoon that Terry and I reached Sorrento and found the campsite. In the cool of the evening we went into the resort and walked round for an hour. Horse-drawn carriages were very much in evidence, and there were many souvenir shops. In one of the shops I bought two bookmarks, a copy of Alex Munt's The Story of San Michele, and an illustrated guide to Pompeii, which we were planning to visit the following day on our way to Naples. The Story of San Michele was a fashionable Swedish doctor's account of his life in Capri in the halcyon days before the First World War, and in particular of the creation of San Michele, the villa we had built there with his own hands, incorporating into it marble fragments from the ruins of the Palace of Tiberius, the old Roman emperor having spent the last years of his life on the island. I had read the book in Bombay on the recommendation of my friend Arjun Dev Rask, a Punjabi poet and scriptwriter of about my own age, and had enjoyed it greatly. That was 10 years ago, and I was glad not only that I had the opportunity to read it again, but that I had come across it and could start reading it in a place so close to Capri, which geologically was an extension of the Sorrento Peninsula, and which we hoped to be able to see from Naples. The illustrated guide to Pompeii, with its photographs of the excavated remains of houses, shops and public buildings, and its artists' reconstructions of what the city must have been like 2,000 years ago, helped prepare us for what we would be seeing and not be seeing on the morrow. In my own case, at least, the name of Pompeii had long been a familiar one. As a boy of 8 or 9, confined to bed with what was believed to be heart disease, I had read Borja Litton's The Last Days of Pompeii, and his vivid account of the city's destruction had left an indelible impression on my mind. From Sorrento onwards, the road round the peninsula was relatively uninteresting, and after Castellammare di Stabia, equidistant from Sorrento and Naples, it passed through an area of an increasingly built-up and industrialised character. Owing to the bad signposting, we experienced some difficulty finding the way to Pompeii, a way which took us eventually through very dirty streets and past piles of garbage. On arriving at our destination, we were surprised to find not the reconstructed pagan temple one might have expected, but a big Roman Catholic church. The church was indeed a basilica, and judging by the fact that all the shops and stalls in the vicinity were selling cheap religious souvenirs, it was a centre of pilgrimage. There was also a pontifical institute, in whose modest museum we saw an interesting series of old prints depicting all the eruptions of Vesuvius from the 17th century onwards, as well as various objects recovered from beneath the layers of volcanic ash which for centuries had covered Pompeii. Thus prepared, we made our way to the excavations, and there spent more than 2 hours treading the pavements of the old city and seeing the remains, in some cases very extensive, of the buildings which the spade of the archaeologist had exposed to view. We saw the spacious forum or marketplace with its lateral rows of truncated columns, the basilica or hall of justice. Some ancient churches so styled were originally public buildings of this type. The House of the Faun, named for the bronze dancing figure that had been found there and whose place was now occupied by a replica. The elegant House of Menander, in the atrium of which there were frescoes of the Sack of Troy and the sad remains of the Temple of Isis, which I remembered as having featured prominently in the last days of Pompeii, together with much else that my diary lumps together under a terse, etc. Many of the objects found at Pompeii were in private hands, but many were in the National Archaeological Museum in Naples, and as we were eager to see them, we drove straight from the excavations to Naples and straight to the museum. The streets through which we passed were all incredibly dirty. Piles of rotting garbage rose breast-high at regular intervals. And in Naples itself, an otherwise beautiful city occupying one of the finest sites in the world, the same filth was to be seen even in the principal thoroughfares. Were the municipal dustmen all on strike then? Or was this the normal state of affairs? We had no means of knowing. The museum, unfortunately, was closed, or rather it closed just after our arrival, either because it was siesta time or because Monday was early closing day. Taking the coastal road, we therefore drove on to Pozzuoli, which was rather cleaner, and from Pozzuoli to the campsite at Solfatara. It was a big, quiet camp with plenty of trees, and I spent much of the evening reading the story of San Michele. As we discovered the following day, the National Archaeological Museum contained not only frescoes, mosaics, and encaustic portraits from Pompeii and its sister in disaster, Herculaneum, but an astonishingly rich array of Greek and Roman antiquities of every kind. On entering the building, we were confronted by a perfect forest of white marble statues in which it was easy, as one wandered from room to crowded room, to get lost. Besides the Farnese Hercules, the group of the Punishment of Dirce, the bronze Hermes in repose, and 100 other sculptures hardly less famous, there were portrait busts of Greek philosophers and Roman emperors, elaborately carved sarcophagi, and colossal statues of river gods. The object that made the strongest impression on me, whether because of its non-naturalistic character, its warmer colouring, or its more subliminal appeal, was the rigidly hieratic statue of the Ephesian Artemis. This was not the fleet-footed virgin goddess of the Greeks, but a deity of a very different kind. Apart from her outstretched hands, her most conspicuous feature were the rows of breasts, more recently identified as the testicles of bulls sacrificed in her honour, that adorned the upper part of her body, and the friezes of beasts that covered the mummy-like remainder. On her head rested a square mitre, and there were more representations of beasts within the flat disc of her halo. Her attitude was reassuring, her expression benign. On our way into Naples that morning, we had enjoyed a fine view of the splendid curve of the bay. We had also encountered roads which, while they may have been wider than those of yesterday, were no less filthy. On emerging from the museum, we therefore lost no time in getting on to the Autostrada del Sole and heading for Rome. This 20th century equivalent of the Appian Way ran through mountainous, well-wooded countryside. At one point we saw, perched on a neighbouring peak, the famed Abbey of Monte Cassino, unfortunately badly damaged during the Second World War. 3 hours after leaving Naples, we were in the Eternal City and looking for the Villa Ada campsite. The first thing we did after having a meal was to go to the camp shop and buy a guidebook. There was a lot to see in Rome, perhaps more than in all the places we had so far seen put together. And during the next 5 days, we probably saw as much of the city and its monuments as could be comfortably seen in so short a time. Each morning we left the campsite straight after breakfast, and each day we spent the morning and much of the afternoon sightseeing. Since we did most of our sightseeing on foot, often in the open air, we were glad the weather was now cooler and that there was an occasional sprinkling of rain. Evenings were spent at the campsite, where we cooked, washed clothes, read, studied our guidebook, and planned the following day's excursion. On the first day, we saw first the Forum of Trajan and the Colosseum, then the Roman Forum and the Palatine Hill. Walked round the whole area and saw everything, my diary records with satisfaction, adding, strong impression of greatness in size rather than in artistic conception. Everything seemed dark and heavy, none of the lightness of Greece. We also visited the Capitoline Museum, among whose treasures were the Dying Gaul, which I found very fine, and the Spinarius, or Boy with a Thorn. The second day began with a visit to the Pantheon, which I found simple but grand, after which we saw St. Peter's in Vincula, with the famous statue of Moses by Michelangelo, which I found rather smaller than I thought it was, and the Basilica of St. Clement, beneath which there was a much older underground church, and what was still more interesting, a Mithraic sanctuary. From St. Clement's, we drove to the Basilica of St. John Lateran, on which my diary comments, big and impressive, but cold. Typical papal triumphalism. Mosaics in apse beautiful, though. Sadly overpowered by a rest of structure. The day's excursions ended in the National Museum in the ruins, which I found stupendous, of the baths of Diocletian, where we saw a marble copy of the Discobolus of Myron, which I found extraordinarily beautiful, the Pugilist at Rest, and the famous relief of the Bath of Hera. Our third day in Rome was devoted to St. Peter's and to the Vatican Museums. Though I could not but agree that the Dome of St. Peter's, Michelangelo's Dome, was one of the most beautiful in the world, I was disappointed by the interior of the vast building. It was magnificent, but it was cold. Walking round the nave, we saw the bronze statue of St. Peter, people were kissing its toe, and Michelangelo's Pietà. We also saw, at the foot of one of the great piers, the altar and bodily remains, apparently complete, of St. Josephat. Could this be the Josephat of the popular medieval legend of Balaam and Josephat, which scholars had shown to be based, ultimately, on a version of the life of the Buddha? Josephat being a corrupted form of Bodhisattva, and Balaam of Bhagawan, or Lord. In that case, the bodily remains of St. Josephat, enshrined there at the very centre of Roman Catholic power and prestige, would be, if genuine, those of Gautama the Buddha. As it happened, the accidents of history had been responsible for no such irony. Years later, I discovered that the St. Josephat, whose remains reposed beneath the dome of St. Peter's, was a Polish bishop, martyred in 1623, who had devoted his life to reuniting the schismatics within the Holy See. But I also discovered that both Balaam and Josephat had a formal place in the role of Christian saints, and that special days in the calendar were set apart in their memory. In the Menology of the Greek Church, the commemoration of St. Josephat was on August the 26th, my own birthday. The Vatican Museums were very much in the plural number. There were at least 5 separate museums, besides numerous galleries, rooms, courts, chapels, loggias, all full of works of art of various kinds, from ancient Greek sculptures to Italian Renaissance paintings, and from Etruscan vases to medieval illuminated manuscripts. By the time Terry and I arrived, the museums had been open for an hour or more, and the tourist season being at its height, the place was uncomfortably crowded. Tremendous crush, my diary records. Working our way through the press, we managed to visit the museums and the Vatican Library, as well as the picture gallery and most of the chapels and apartments. With so many people everywhere, it was at times difficult to get a proper view of the works of art, and the only ones of which I have a distinct recollection are the Laocoon and the Apollo Belvedere, which I found grey with dust, especially on the shoulders, and Raphael's School of Athens. The Sistine Chapel was particularly crowded, but we sat there for a while, gazing up at Michelangelo's frescoes of the Creation on the ceiling and at the frescoes of the Last Judgment on the wall behind the high altar. Our next day's excursion took us initially to the semi-rural outskirts of Rome and to the catacombs of St. Domitilla and St. Calixtus. The former appeared to be the less well-known of the two. At any rate, Terry and I were the only visitors, and the young man who showed us round appeared to be the only guide there was. I had not realised that these early Christian underground cemeteries were so extensive. The catacombs of St. Domitilla were on four levels. At each level there was a network of galleries, the different levels being connected by flights of steps. Excavated from the dark volcanic rock, the galleries were only a few feet in width, and the walls on either side were lined from floor to ceiling with row upon row of horizontal burial niches. There was also a small restored basilica, the upper part of which had originally projected above the ground. At the catacombs of St. Calixtus, there were a dozen or more visitors, and our guide was a well-informed young Canadian priest. There were between 12 and 14 miles of galleries on four levels, he told us, before we followed him down the steps into the dimly lit passages in the labyrinth below. The principal objects of interest were the Crypt of the Popes, which contained the sarcophagi of 9 3rd century pontiffs, and the Crypt of St. Cecilia, where there was a marble copy of Modena's recumbent statue of the martyred patroness of music. In the afternoon, having cashed travellers' checks in the Piazza di Spagna and looked in vain for affordable marble statuary, we drove to the Villa Borghese. It had just closed for the siesta, so taking the hint, we went and had a siesta of our own back at the campsite, returning 3 hours later to view one of the choicest collections of sculptures and paintings we had so far encountered. There was Bernini's David, together with his Apollo and Daphne and the Rape of Persephone, all of which I thought particularly fine, as well as Cranach's Venus and Cupid, Caravaggio's St. Jerome, Dossi's Circe, and Titian's Sacred and Profane Love. Our fifth and last day in Rome happened to be a Sunday, and the streets through which we drove on our way to the Church of St. Ignatius, the Church of the Jesuits, were comparatively deserted. The interior of the imposing Jesuit Baroque building was highly ornate, with gilding and coloured marbles very much in evidence. Mass was still in progress, the congregation being a fairly large one, in which there were many nuns, all conspicuous in the black, white, blue or parti-coloured habits of their respective orders. Afterwards we went and looked at the sumptuous polychrome marble altar of St. Ignatius, said to be the richest monument in Rome, and gazed up the famous trompe d'oeil fresco of the Triumph of St. Ignatius in the cupola of the church. From the Gesù he walked the few hundred yards to Santa Maria sopra Minerva, which I thought extremely beautiful and impressive, the only large Gothic church in the city. It was a church of the Dominicans, and though I did not realise it at the time, In a marble sarcophagus under the high altar lay the body of St. Catherine of Siena. Having sat through Mass, celebrated for the benefit of a very small congregation, we walked round the building and saw the tomb of Fra Angelico and the chapel dedicated to St. Thomas Aquinas. Our next port of call was Santa Maria in Cosmedin. In order to get there, we had not only to drive along the bank of the Tiber, but also to cross the river more than once, which meant that we had a good view of the famous boat-shaped island. Santa Maria in Cosmedin was a simple church, and its 9th century interior, unlike that of the Gesu, was simple to the point of austerity. Nearby stood the Temple of Vesta, where the Vestal Virgins had once tended the sacred fire. The principal object of the morning's excursion, however, was St. Paul's outside the walls, which, as its name suggested, was situated beyond the walls that had surrounded the ancient city. Dating from the 4th century, this was a basilica-type church, and next to St. Peter's, the biggest church in Rome. More truly grand than St. Peter's, my diary records admiringly, especially the interior. The latter consisted of a nave and four aisles. From the alabaster windows of the clerestory, a soft amber light fell on the long double rows of Corinthian columns, lit up the carved and gilded ceiling and the glittering mosaics of the chancel arch, and penetrated into the apse. The overall impression was one of peace and harmony. No less peaceful were the cloisters, round which Terry and I walked as soon as the sung mass was over and the congregation had dispersed. On our way back into the city, we passed the pyramid of Caius Sestius, which Shelley described as the wedge sublime, and the baths of Caracalla, and paid a second visit to the Colosseum, where Terry took photographs. Our last stop was at Santa Maria Maggiore, a 5th century basilica church, the interior of which my diary pronounces glorious, and where there was the biggest congregation we had seen that day. During our 5 days in Rome, some monuments and some works of art naturally impressed me more deeply than others, but there were 3 monuments that must have made a particularly deep impression, inasmuch as for many years they occupied, in recollection, the forefront of my picture of Rome, everything else being relegated to the background. The 3 were the Colosseum, the Pantheon, and the Catacombs. In the case of the Colosseum, it was not the actual building I remembered so much as the experience I had there. During which of our 2 visits the experience took place, I do not know. Probably it was during the 2nd, when I wandered off on my own while Terry was taking his photographs. Whichever it was, as I stood at the centre of the vast amphitheatre, I became aware of all the blood that had been shed there, of all the human beings and animals that had been, quote, butchered to make a Roman holiday on that spot. I did not simply remember having read about such horrors in books. It was as though the pain and terror that had accompanied those countless dreadful deaths had left permanent traces on the atmosphere of the place, and that I was picking up those traces. My memory of the Pantheon was of a very different kind. It was a memory not of the exterior of the 2nd century building, grand as this was, so much as its hemispherical interior. As I stood beneath the centre of the vast dome, looking up through the circular opening that was the principal source of light, it was as though I was standing on the surface of the earth and looking through a hole in the outermost crystalline sphere of the Ptolemaic universe, the sphere of the fixed stars, directly into the Empyrean. If in the Pantheon I ascended in spirit to the heights, in the catacombs I descended into the depths. The descent was as much temporal as spatial. It was a descent not only into terrene depths, but also into the dark, backward, and abyss of time. From there, one could see how vast was the difference between the splendour of the ornate triumphalist structures of the church's latter days and the stark simplicity of those tomb-lined subterranean galleries. Christianity had changed radically in the course of its 1900 years of history. In St. Peter's, one breathed a very different atmosphere, spiritually speaking, from that which one breathed in the catacombs. Pagan temples may have been converted into places of Christian worship, but Rome was still Rome, and the Pope was the successor in many respects, not so much of the Prince of the Apostles as of Caesar. Back at the Villa Ada campsite, we had a meal, rested and read, and then at 5 o'clock left for Florence by the Autostrada del Sole. The countryside through which we passed was pleasant, but not very interesting, and except for Orvieto on its rock, we saw nothing remarkable in the course of our journey. At 8:30 we reached Florence, where we soon located the International, as the campsite was called. Though it was the best campsite we had seen in Italy, very few people were staying there, and we had the olive grove in which we were parked all to ourselves. When darkness fell, we could see the lights of the Certosa, the monastery of the Carthusians, glittering in the distance. Our 5 days in Rome had left us with a multitude of impressions to digest, and it was perhaps for this reason that in the morning neither my friend nor I felt like going anywhere. We were content, instead, to stay in the olive grove and read. For the last few days I had been reading A.H. Armstrong's An Introduction to Ancient Philosophy and Carl Jaspers's Way to Wisdom, but I now put them aside in favour of Plato's First Alcibiades and the Svetasvatara and the Kaivalya Upanishads. Why I should have wanted to read the Upanishads there in Florence, or indeed have taken a volume of these ancient Hindu scriptures with me to Italy and Greece in the first place, I do not know. Perhaps I was unconsciously preparing for my forthcoming visit to India. During my first 2 or 3 years in the East, I had studied the Upanishads intensively, and the Svetasvatara, or White Horse Upanishad, was a great favourite of mine. I was particularly fond of its more poetical verses, such as those in which the inspired author of the Upanishad, addressing the god Rudra, a form of Shiva, exclaims, "You are the dark blue bird, you are the green parrot with red eyes, you are the cloud with the lightning in its womb, you are the seasons and the seas." The image of the green parrot with red eyes had stayed with me ever since. There were no green parrots in our olive grove. In view of the Italian sportsman's penchant for shooting anything that moved, there were probably no birds there at all. Birds or no birds, the grove was very peaceful, and Terry and I spent the best part of our first day in Florence happily absorbed in our books. At 4 o'clock, however, having completed a few chores, we both experienced a change of mood and decided to drive into the city. Half an hour later, we were in the Piazza del Duomo. The huge cathedral with its red-tiled dome and polychrome marble facing, the tall, slim bell tower, and the octagonal baptistry were all looking extremely beautiful in the rays of the setting sun, and formed between them what was perhaps the most harmonious complex of buildings we had seen in Italy. The interior of the cathedral was dimly lit and cavernous, that of the much smaller baptistry lined with coloured marbles and Byzantine mosaics. We were particularly drawn to Ghiberti's bronze-gilt east doors of the baptistry, the Doors of Paradise, Michelangelo called them, and spent some time looking at these sculptured panels depicting biblical scenes and at the statuettes of prophets and sibyls. In the streets nearby there were several good bookshops, in one of which I bought Burckhardt's Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy for myself, as well as Luigi Barzini's The Italians, and the modern library Philosophy of Kant for Terry, who at that time was reading Will Durant's Outlines of Philosophy. We also looked at various other shops. The level of craftsmanship was higher than anything we had found elsewhere in Italy. And Terry bought two cheap but attractive necklaces, one for Nikki and one for Vivian. Unlike Rome, where the ancient and the modern existed in uncomfortable juxtaposition, Florence, the cradle of the Renaissance, had succeeded in relegating modern urban and industrial development to the hinterland of the old historic city. Terry and I were made aware of this fact when we drove the following morning across the River Arno and up to the broad sunlit expanse of the Piazzale Michelangelo, in the centre of which there stood a monument dedicated to the great artist. As we looked from the balcony of the Piazzale, which commanded a panoramic view of practically the whole of Florence, we saw a perfect sea of red-tiled roofs out of which there arose, looking for all the world like a ship serenely riding waves made red by the rays of the sun, the great bulk of the cathedral. Where the Red Sea ended, there stretched the smudged grey line of the more modern part of the city, while beyond the grey line there rose, tier upon tier, the green, gently undulant Tuscan hills. For some time we stood gazing down at the scene. The sun shone, the air was completely still, and not a sound came up to us from below. I felt much as Wordsworth must have felt when, crossing Westminster Bridge in the early morning on his way to France, as he looked from the top of the coach at the City of London, quote, "The city glideth at its own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still." The Arno, no less than the Thames, may well have glided at its own sweet will, but as Terry and I quickly discovered on descending from the Piazzale and recrossing the river, the houses of Florence were certainly not asleep that morning, and its heart was far from still. Florence was a busy, bustling, crowded place, and nowhere was it more crowded than in the Uffizi Gallery, which we visited after going round the Palazzo Vecchio, or Old Palace, of the Signoria, and looking at Cellini's Perseus and other sculptures in the arcades of the adjacent loggia. There were more than 40 rooms in the Uffizi. Only two or three of them were closed at the time, and despite the crush, we managed to shoulder and squeeze our way into all the rest. How Terry felt about the paintings, I do not remember, but for my part, I particularly enjoyed the Botticelli room, where the Allegory of Spring, the Birth of Venus, and other masterpieces from the hand of the same artist were on view. By the time we left the Uffizi, we were both feeling rather tired, though this was due not so much to our having been so long on our feet as to the fact that the gallery had been so uncomfortably crowded. After looking at the souvenir stalls in the marketplace and buying a few provisions, we therefore headed back to our peaceful olive grove, where we spent the rest of the day by ourselves. I continued reading The Italians, while Terry made a start on Kant, but did not find the philosopher very easy going. For the remainder of our stay in Florence, our daily programme followed much the same pattern. The morning was spent sightseeing, the afternoon and evening reading in the olive grove. In a way, it was unfortunate that we were seeing Florence towards the end of our tour, rather than at the beginning, for by this time we had seen so many cities, monuments, archaeological sites and works of art, and even I was beginning to feel fatigued, and we were not perhaps in a position to appreciate the glories of Florence as much as we might otherwise have done. Moreover, Terry felt rather depressed after one of our forays, and one morning, on our way into the city, I felt sick and faint. Nonetheless, in the course of the next 3 days, we visited Santa Maria Novella, San Marco, Santa Croce, and other churches, the Gallery of the Academy, and the Medici Chapels, and besides sculptures by Michelangelo, including his David and various unfinished captives, saw paintings by Fra Angelico, Botticelli, and Masaccio, as well as the tunic and girdle of St. Francis, the allegedly miraculous veil of the Virgin, and in the crypt of San Miniato, situated on a hill above the Piazzale Michelangelo, what my diary describes as strange relics. In the evenings we read. I finished The Italians and started on The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. Terry continued reading Outlines of Philosophy. On our last day in Florence, I read Dante's La Vita Nuova, the Penguin translation of which I had bought that morning, when Terry and I were looking for presents for our friends, a search that took us as far as the shops on either side of the Ponte Vecchio, or Old Bridge, which had been blown up by the retreating Germans in 1944 and subsequently restored. I had first read La Vita Nuova, or The New Life, when I was 14 or 15, and it seemed fitting that I should read it again while staying in the city of the poet's birth. Though my friend and I were not in a position to appreciate Florence as much as we might have done, the overall impression that the city left on me, at least, was a distinctive one. The predominant note of Florence was beauty, even as the predominant note of Rome was grandeur. The city as a whole was beautiful, that is, the red-roofed historic city of which the cathedral was the centre, and it was full of beautiful things. There were beautiful churches, chapels and palaces. And the churches, chapels and palaces themselves were full of beautiful paintings and sculptures. Even the people seemed more beautiful than those in other parts of Italy. Certainly, they were more smartly dressed, particularly the slim, elegant women, who, more often than not, were stylishly clad in fashionable black and left behind them a trail of delicate perfume. At the same time, I noticed that the beauty that was Florence's predominant note was, at its best, a sober, even an austere beauty. This was especially true of the Palazzo Vecchio, whose vast square bulk and solitary corner tower dominated the square of that name, as well as of the city's numerous Renaissance palaces, some of them now museums or art galleries. Severe horizontal lines and rusticated stonework of which gave me a particularly keen thrill of aesthetic delight. I also noticed that Florence set great store by the memory of her great men, whose names were to be met with on every side. Dante, Giotto, Masaccio, Donatello, Verrocchio, Leonardo da Vinci, Alberti, Brunelleschi, Fra Angelico, Botticelli, Michelangelo, Cosimo and Lorenzo de' Medici, Savonarola, Marsilio Ficino, Galileo. The list seemed endless. Florence, in fact, valued her great men. She valued them because they were individuals, and she valued individuality. It was therefore not surprising that Burckhardt, writing of biography in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance and comparing the two, should have pointed out that the search for the characteristic features of remarkable men was a prevailing tendency among the Italians, and that this it was that separated them from other Western peoples, among whom the same thing happened, but rarely, and in exceptional cases. What was true of the Italians of the Renaissance generally was true, it seemed, of the citizens of Florence in particular, and as Burckhardt had gone on to observe, quote, "This keen eye for individuality belongs only to those who have emerged from the half-conscious life of the race, and become themselves individuals." Neither Terry nor I slept much that night. This may have been due to the fact that our last night in Florence was also our last night in Italy, and because we both knew that once we had left Italy, our tour would be virtually over, for we did not think of Belgium and the other countries through which we had passed on our way to Italy and eventually to Greece, and through which we would be passing in reverse order on our way back to England, as forming part of our true itinerary. But though we had not slept much and were feeling rather tired, we rose early, left the campsite at 6 o'clock as planned, and were soon on the autostrada to Milan. It was a fine, cool morning. The countryside through which we passed was at first rather hilly, with plenty of cypresses, but afterwards it became quite flat, and remained flat for the rest of our journey. At Milan, which we reached 4 hours after leaving Florence, we picked up the autostrada to Como, where we halted for a while beside the lake, then drove on to Chiasso. Though the customs formalities took only a few seconds, so heavy was the traffic that we spent nearly an hour getting from one side of the Italian-Swiss frontier to the other. Once across, we drove on to Lugano, where we decided to halt, having by this time been on the road for 9 hours. The two lakeside campsites were full, but eventually we found a site away from the town on the bank of a small river, and there passed the night.